and welcome to Cinemakers, Steven Soderbergh. This is episode 18, Bubble, from 2005. I am Tobin Addington.
I'm Mike Manzi.
And I'm Joey Lewandowski. And this, I have a memory that the first time I ever heard of this movie was in Tobin's World Cinema Movements class, where you talked about how revolutionary this film was, because it was one of the first ones, or maybe the first one. It was released in theaters and on HDNet, a TV channel, on the same day, and then it came out on DVD like 3 days later. As far as I'm concerned, that's about where the end of revolutionary things kind of, that's all that's sort of worth talking about with this movie. It's cool that he used local actors. He just found local talent. I think we've seen that done better since, like with Joe and such. Shout out to Cage Club. But this movie, thank God it's short, because it, oh boy. And especially, I mean, I'm sort of condensing a lot of my thoughts right up front here, but like, especially after the girl dies and like things have to get heavy, I'm like, oh, nobody can really pull this off as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, this is, you know, coming down from Ocean's 12 and then again going to the complete opposite end of the spectrum where we've got like zero budget, zero actors, zero script. We're just going to go to the middle of nowhere and shoot a movie and hopefully like something's going to come of it. It's just, I admire Soderbergh for going back to film school every now and again like he does, but it could be frustrating at times, and this is kind of one of those times for me. I think, you know, I think that it's quick is good. I actually like the way it looks. I think he is able to shoot digital better than a lot of people, even still today, but especially in 2005. You know, I think it has its moments, but for the most part, yeah, I wasn't really too thrilled with this one.
I'm worried, before Tobin speaks, that Tobin's going to love and defend this movie.
I'm going to love and defend this movie, guys.
I knew it.
Look, I don't love this movie the way I love Out of Sight. This is by no means a perfect movie. And I think revolutionary is the wrong word. I'm hoping that what I said in that class was that this was a revolutionary... Well, I know what we were talking about. We were talking about the digital revolution was the name of,
yes,
of the day that we spent 3 hours talking
and
about these movies.
Bear in mind, this was a class 10 years ago, almost to the month. Like, this is... It's been a while, so I don't know what the context was, but probably
you're right. I would not argue that the movie itself is revolutionary. I do think you are right that maybe the most interesting thing for non-filmmakers about this movie is the idea that this is one of the times he began to play, that his experiments went beyond how the movie was made and began to tackle how the movie was released. It's a thing he's going to play with both sort of in terms of how movies are financed and made all the way through how they're released. So outside of the actual production of the movie, he's going to be experimenting with film in that way from this point on,
which he's still doing to this day. As we record this, Logan Lucky comes out this weekend, and in that GQ article, which was great, which I linked a couple times on the Cage Club Facebook page, facebook.com/CageClub and @CageClubPod on Twitter, about how like you sell the foreign distribution rights to make the movie, and then you sell like the Netflix rights to get it into theaters here, and then you just profit. And so like I love that 12 years later he's even refined it further, and I do think that, but go ahead, I'm sorry to cut you off, but he's still doing it today.
Let me mount the opening statement in my defense of the movie as a movie. So setting aside how it was released and that whole thing, and recognizing the fact that this might be only of interest to people who are sort of deep cinephiles or filmmakers, the idea that it's not like he's working with non-actors the way you have in Joe, because Joe, you're working with Nicolas Cage as your star. That is not a non-actor. This is a movie built entirely around non-actors. This is a movie built entirely around the way these people live. And one of the things, when I teach a scene from this movie frequently, this movie is about these three people living in sort of deep in Rust Belt in a sort of hardscrabble Ohio and working at a doll factory. And there's a moment where one of the characters is brought into the factory. It's 10 minutes into the movie. She's brought into the factory and introduced to the group. And you get these series of shots. And one of them is of our main character, this woman named Martha, who's probably in her 40s, and she's overweight, and she's got red hair, and She does not look like the lead actor in your movie.
She looks like someone who you would find at a KFC drive-thru, which is where they actually found her. She was working at KFC drive-thru, and they said, would you like to be in our movie? And she said yes.
She's a manager at KFC. Mm-hmm. So, and had worked there for 24 years by the time they shot this movie. So when I show this to the class, I'm showing it for a variety of reasons I won't get into, but then one of the questions asked at the end is, who do you think is the main character of the movie? And no one ever guesses her. And I would submit from just those shots, and you wouldn't really know from the shots necessarily. It's just sort of to say, to demonstrate that we have some bias in who we think, you know, or who does get to star. The institutional bias in movies about who gets to star in movies made by Oscar-winning directors. And it's not these people. And the fact that this movie is about people and ways of life that don't get movies made about them, I think to start with, that's the beginning of my defense, is that what a great way to take a bath after the sort of slick, super rich Oceans, you know, the artifice of Oceans, to go sort of as humanist and as miniature and as a sort of hard scrabble existence as you can. I think that's a star for this movie.
I totally appreciate all that. And I don't dislike this movie. I didn't love watching it. I think it's tough to, like, I don't think this is a movie that's really made to be enjoyable. I don't think. Would you agree with that?
I find this movie extremely mundane. I mean, it's literally a step away from, like, voyeur cam or something, like just watching people at work, like real people, which I don't feel like that strengthens the point of any of the themes going on. Like, I almost would have valued the movie more if these were real actors, like more of an Aaron Brockovich situation where you have these situations or you have these small towns and these events occurring that people aren't really, you know, privy to, or they don't get national attention, or, you know, you don't know how bad the recession is or how poor the town really is. Like, I get a lot of it. I get what he's doing. I just don't really feel the impact maybe as much as he wants me to. I appreciate it. Like, I'm glad he tried doing something like this because, you know, frankly, no one else at his level is, right? Everyone is just sort of seems like they're playing it safe. So I do admire him for that, but I just feel like the movie was just way too simple and not intriguing and kind of wraps itself up really quickly and it's over before you know it. I don't know. I just really didn't feel anything from it.
I can feel Tobin cringing through the microphone.
But that's okay.
This is good. This is good. I, for my part, I find this movie to be intensely alive. I don't think this is mundane at all. I think these shots at the beginning of them working, this is all about isolation for these people. Like, they don't speak when they work, and they're putting together these really creepy shots of them, of the dolls being made in this factory.
Well, if you think dolls are creepy, yeah, which they are, it, you know, that's just like deep-rooted stuff right there I think he's honing in on. It's like creepy doll imagery. It's going to unnerve you.
And these shots of the young man with all this, just this machinery around him, like, all this, they're isolated in these, like, within the shots, as well as just surrounded by this massive machinery, which has to do with the, you know, like, they're making these dolls to be given out at Christmas to kids or whatever, right? Like, they are under the wheels of capitalism. This is the whole, and that's sort of visually represented every time that they're in this terribly lit, buzzing, noisy, like, these are the people who are in Metropolis, who live deep underneath the top, right? Like, that's what we're looking at here. And I think the thing that makes it, for me, makes that so vital, it's the main relationship between this 40-year-old woman, Martha, and the young man, I forget what his name was, that they have this, like, relationship that is both strange and tender and creepy. And I think that to set that odd, strange relationship in the middle of this dislocated, isolated, machine-filled world is, I find it very alive.
Maybe the movie needed an extra 15 or 20 minutes because there's barely any of that set up. You really have to draw that out yourself. Like, there's one scene when they're driving to work together and she's like, you're my best friend, I need your picture. And he's like, okay, whatever. But they really are just co-workers. I got the sense that maybe she's a little delusional, and throughout the movie I feel like that's... that's revealed to be the case from where I'm standing. But yeah, I didn't really get a great sense of their character per se. I get the isolated stuff in it, but for me, what I saw was, these are empty factories, all of our jobs are overseas. You know, that's the point I was picking up from that mainly.
Well, that's also depressing. The only thing that I really gathered from the factory is that they're making these, like, creepy or not, but they're making these, like, beautiful, happy little baby doll faces that directly compare that to the rest of, like, the juxtaposition of the dullness of their life. And it's like, oh, like, where does, like, this joy come from for little girls? It's from these, you know, depressed, broke, middle-aged, friendless people, right? Like, it just, that sort of resonated with me. In terms of what you were saying, Mike, in terms of, like, trying to see what's going on, like, this is a movie, like, it feels like it shouldn't be, but this is a movie that I read the Wikipedia article while watching, because I was like, wait, did I miss something? And, like, no, it's just, she is really close friends with him, and he doesn't really reciprocate it. And I'm just like, oh, like, I agree with you that I think that could have maybe set up a little bit more. I mean, I don't think it's terribly set up, but I think that it feels so short that, like, not that I would want it longer. I don't know what I want. It does feel like something to me is kind of missing. And also, the other thing that I want to say is that there is a deleted scene on the DVD where you find out that she has, like, a malignant tumor in her brain, that Martha has a tumor. Oh. And so she's, which I think is terrible. Like, if that was in the movie, like, that's, oh boy.
That would have shined a light on why there's that blue light at times, though, perhaps. Like, when she's sitting in church and then the blue light shines on her, I'm like, oh, okay. And then at the very end, when she sees the blue light, and I guess then she sees in her mind that she actually did commit the crime. And I was like, oh, I just sort of chalked that up to, like, revelation or something in her own head. But it was supposed to be like she had a tumor. Like, that's kind of crazy.
It's funny because I got tumor when I saw the film. I guessed tumor. You don't know. You don't know that. But, like, you know, is she mentally ill? Has she been broken by religion since the first place you do see it is in church? I love those moments where the movie suddenly goes from this sort of objective, you know, we're just watching these people doing these things, then so subjective into her mind, into her soul in some way, the way she sort of sees this world. I find those moments pretty electric. I want to circle back to one thing, Mike, that you were saying, where you said it's a movie that you have to draw out, that where you have to do a lot of the work. And that's really true. This is a thing that, again, I admire about him, and I may have a different sort of tolerance for, given the kinds of things that I watch. But I like that you have to watch this movie. You have to invest in, you have to be an active viewer to sort of meet this movie. Like some movies in the spectrum of entertainment, and they're movies that you could just sit back, that just happen in front of, they happen to you. They come all the way to you. They bring everything you need to enjoy the movie, to appreciate the movie, right up to you. And you can just sit back and relax. Then there are movies that you have to just, avant-garde movies where it's nothing but a white screen for 25 minutes, that you have to bring everything to, because they haven't done anything to the film to make it a movie, right? And this is not that, but it's somewhere closer to that in the spectrum. It's clearly a story. There are clearly characters, but you're totally right. This is not a, I'm very glad this movie did not have a tighter script, you know. And that said, it has an inciting incident. It has rising action. It has a midpoint. It has an all is lost moment. It has all the things that we, you know, that make a story. It's just to get the full experience of what he's trying to get, you have to walk toward the movie. You have to sort of develop it on your own. You have to meet it partway.
Yeah, for as simple and basic it is, it's actually kind of well coded, you know. And I found something extremely Soderbergh about this movie, and in the way that he has sort of explored communication throughout his films, you know. In a lot of movies, you know, characters, you know, even in the last movie where we had the lost in translation sequence in Ocean's 12, where people are speaking gibberish, but they understand exactly what they mean. I mean, we've seen this come up time and again with him, and I feel like he's there in full force with this movie, with the characters. Like, it's all about the manners, right? Mm-hmm. Their mannerisms, mm-hmm. The way they look at each other, but they may not see how other people look at them. And then the dialogue, there's just, not only is there such little dialogue, but it's just like, the most we get is the girl talking about her old job, you know? And, like, none of it really, I mean, it tells you a little bit about her as a person, but it doesn't really propel, like, the story or the plot or anything like that. Like, it's all just very conversational type stuff. Yeah, and I think that's what adds to sort of having to figure them out yourself, as opposed to being told explicitly, like, this is the type of person they are, this is what they're capable of.
Yeah, I think that the dialogue is really interesting in this movie, because it's clearly a lot of it is improvised. And I think that one of the things that we're going to begin to connect in some of his smaller movies going forward is that they're very much about how people make money. And so much of the conversation that goes on is about, hey, can you babysit? I can pay you. What are you going to do with your bonus if we get a bonus? The moment where Rose steals the money from his drawer, you know, where he doesn't even have a bank account. He just has money set aside in his room for emergencies. Like, part of it, I think, for me too, is that this is – you know, I grew up in an area that had a lot of working poor, and I recognize that. I think that that's something that what it means then is that the dialogue is not about advancing the plot. It's about illuminating the characters, but only through how they live, what their concerns are day to day. And I think that's kind of an amazing thing in a you know, a quote unquote Hollywood movie.
Which also is all the more striking and gut-wrenching, I guess, when you compare it to the last movie where these guys just stole $200 million. Like, oh, we'll just steal another $200 million to pay it off. We just happen across money so effortlessly. And, like, look at our faces. Like, look how handsome we are. And then here you're like, oh, we're going to get a $50 bonus. Like, what are you going to do with all that money? And, like, we see them at least once, if not, I feel like this whole movie sort of takes place at a fast food restaurant.
Yeah.
Like, they're at least there at least once, right? If not more, just having a conversation there. And it's like, oh, like, they just don't spend money on things. And it's sort of, it's reflected in the movie making too, which I like, in that these are actually their houses, and like, they're not spending money on finding locations, they're just shooting where they can and where they can for free. I don't necessarily like this movie more than I did when we first started this, but I do want to make clear that of all of his weirder experimental things, his sort of non-Hollywood stuff, I do like this more, and I would definitely rewatch this over, like, Full Frontal or K Street or, you know, all that kind of stuff. Like, there's something about this that I really like. It's just, I get what he wants to do, and I just think that this specific iteration of it doesn't work for me. And I read that this is the first of like six movies he was going to do like this. Did he ever do another one this way, or is this sort of like a failure that they just didn't continue this distribution style?
I feel like he goes back to these roots again with stuff like Girlfriend Experience, where it's like, I'm just going to grab like one, well, she was a porn star at the time, right? Sasha Grey. So it's like, I'm going to go outside the industry, grab this one porn star, and then make this movie with her. So I feel like he goes back to this type of filmmaking, but I don't think anything's like in a series of bubble movies or anything like that.
I think that Girlfriend Experience is the other one that they made under the deal. I could be wrong, but my memory when it came out is that that was the next one. And then Magic Mike wasn't, but sort of could have been. We'll get there when we get there, in terms of its concerns with money and some of the casting choices in that movie. But no, they didn't. They certainly didn't do all movies, and they didn't do them the way that he had planned to do it.
I do feel like this movie, like, I would watch it again because I do like the way it's shot, like, a lot, actually. I normally don't like movies you can tell are shot on video because they seem blown out or overexposed, but he's got such a good eye. He knows exactly, like, the values in which he's working in and what's going to read and what won't. And I feel like he's going to, you know, this is like an extension of his low light to no light running gun style. And I think we're going to get a few more movies that look somewhat like this. Like, it was reminding me of The Informant and later movies, and even Behind the Candelabra. Like, I feel like those movies look a little bit like this movie too. So, I mean, I do feel like there is merit to this film. I like a lot of what's going on. It's just, as like a movie, as like a story, it just didn't, I just wasn't like completely with it by the end. I just needed more for it to work as like a complete movie for me, and not just like as an experiment or something.
This movie was shot using the same camera as Star Wars Episode III and Sin City. And if you think about how those movies look, and then how this movie looks, it's like...
But those movies were shot on green screens.
Well, yeah, I understand that. I mean, especially, I mean, like, all of Sin City is, like, basically 99% green screen. But, like, it gets impressive how sort of dirty and ugly and messy this looks. Like, it fits
right.
The tone, which I appreciate, yeah.
And that's totally by design. This is, again, we're coming off of something as slick as an Ocean's movie. This is what I think his soul needs to go. I would suggest, next time you have 73 minutes or however long this movie is, giving it another shot. I find that it, you know, I was intrigued by it when I first saw it. And then like the second and third times, it sort of opened up further for me. And I think this is the fourth or fifth time that I've seen it. And I, you know, when Rose shows up, when this young woman shows up and sort of drops in this and turns into this not quite love triangle, but this relationship triangle between the established relationship of the 40-year-old woman Martha and the young man Kyle, and then Rose shows up, this young woman. There's a tension that shows up in the movie at that point. Every shot of Martha watching the two of them get closer and how threatened she is by everything that Rose does. And you can't tell at first, is Rose really just being genuine, or is she like out to kind of get Martha in some way? You know, I think that one of the things you can't do with this movie is do anything else when you're watching it. If you're checking Twitter, if you're watching something else on the side. This is a movie that does, to be fully appreciated, I think does need your attention. And given that you could watch it like 5 times in the space of The Dark Knight, I think one could give it...
I do think that, like, this is another example where a lot of these Soderbergh movies I'm seeing for the first time, and I'm having a harder time talking about them than I did about Cage or Keanu, because there I'm able to focus in on one specific thing. Here we're sort of judging it as a whole, and when I'm watching a movie for the first time, I'm trying to take notes and trying to remember what happened in the sequence and, like, what I think, and reflecting back on previous movies or previous shots or previous discussions we've had, it's a lot different. Whereas, like, if Cage leaves the screen, I can sort of mentally check out, write down what I think, and then sort of get back to it. You know what I mean? Like, it's a different experience doing this, and I still don't think that I'm good at talking about it this way, because there's just so much more to appreciate or talk about. Even if you don't like it, even if you don't, doesn't click for you, doesn't work for you, you sort of can't look away at all, because every shot is, especially with him, every shot is so careful and every shot is so precise and chosen for a certain reason. And if you look down to take a note and you look back up and there's, you know, you might have missed a Martha glance or something, you're like, oh, well, I, you know, it's small, but it adds up to be a big difference.
Yeah, it is sort of a different way of watching movies for podcasts. Like, it's almost as if Cage was every character in the movie, you know? Like, you have to pay close attention to everything all the time, right? Whereas, like you said...
Well, it's not even like Cage is every character, but Cage is every character, and also every background is also Cage, and, like, all the music is just, like, him singing, and then also all of the editing. Like, it's all just, like, everything is him.
Well, this is the second time I saw it. I saw it originally because of the gimmick. I was like, oh, a movie I could get on DVD the same day as in theaters. It's not even playing near me anyway. So, like, I fell for that. And I enjoyed it back in the day. I mean, this was around the time where 2005, I guess I was going back to school and taking film, like, way serious at that point. So I probably liked it a lot more then when I was, like, starting to get into, like, indie films a lot deeper and just weirder stuff. But this time, again, I don't know, I grew a little impatient, to be quite honest. I just needed there to be more velocity to it. I felt like if they were going to keep it slow, I needed to feel that dread or menace a little harder. I got it with a few shots, but I got the sense that I was supposed to be maybe a little more unnerved throughout the film than I was feeling. And I just wish that I felt the way the movie wanted me to feel about it. But I don't know. I just don't really get the impact. But I can appreciate what he's going for. I like the interloper sort of development. I feel like that was a good direction to start taking some of the non-action to, like, get us going somewhere. I was like, okay, this is something you can work with, this little triangle thing between these three people. But again, like, I just wish we had a little something else.
What did you guys think after the murder happens with sort of the investigation, with how the cops and the specifically the detective and all that stuff was handled?
Well, that just felt like an actual cop, like how he would proceed. That to me felt like the realest stuff in the entire movie, mm-hmm. as if they just gave the cop all the that actor knew what was going on, but the people he was talking to didn't. I actually liked that section of the film a little more, the investigation into what happened.
I don't know. Like, I was just... Not that I want something. Again, another shout-out flashback to Cage Club, where we have the frozen ground, where there's that interrogation scene at the end, where they're sort of breaking John Cusack. Yeah. And, like, he just has, like, this meltdown. I was just waiting, but, like, I got the sense that nothing really big was going to happen, and nothing big does really happen, because it's sort of, you know, a by-the-book detective talking to a woman who is sick, and not necessarily simple in, like, a simple way, but, like, you know, not fully aware of what she's doing, and we weren't going to have this big emotional moment, and it just sort of, it's an anticlimactic wrap-up in the way that the entire movie is. It's intentionally so, and I understand that, but I just wanted something. It feels like this whole movie is just sort of, unless you're paying super close attention to these sideways glances that you're talking about, and there is some kind of, you know, frenetic music that I noticed throughout, but, like, it feels like it's just a straight line kind of across, I think. And I think that's reflective of the town, reflective of their lives, but in terms of watching something that is immersive or that you really get invested in, it didn't click for me.
I think that there's an interesting thing that sort of came up for me watching it this time, which you just sort of brought up again, which is the idea that, like, no one pays attention to these people. By no one, I mean, you know, the Hollywood apparatus does not pay attention to these people. And we are not programmed to invest in these kind of characters in the same way. And the movie reflects that by the way they're shown to us. They're not, you know, she doesn't have a save the cat moment. There's no, we don't know anything about her other than that she sews and she lives with her dad and she's really likes hanging out with this kid. You know, it's really not, it's not going to sort of deliver on any of those other things. I think the cop is great. I totally agree. He feels like a, and maybe was, probably was, given what the way this movie was made. I don't know for sure, but an actual detective or had been an investigator of some kind. Because it just feels like the way this kind of thing would actually go. Like, you're not, you, there's no junk, junk, you know, from Law and Order or whatever. Like, it's just he's going about his business. This is a guy doing a job the same way they're people doing jobs. And I think that if I would knock the movie for the one place where for me the non-acting acting sort of doesn't work really well is the scene where Kyle is being interrogated by the cop and is told that Rose is dead. And like suddenly you see like here's a person who's supposed to be getting news that the young woman he went on a date with last night has been murdered. And he just doesn't have the acting capacity to be able to sell that moment. But I do think that for me, the interrogation at the end between the detective and Martha, where he tells her that she really has done it, I find that very emotional. She is acting from such a genuine place in that moment. And yeah, it's not a big climactic thing, but in her life, this is huge. And I just feel that she, as a non-actor, was able to access some place of great pain and despair in that moment. And in a way that I don't think an actor would have. I don't think a trained actor could have given that performance. And if nothing else in this movie is sort of worth your time, the build up to and then landing on that moment, as small and as quiet and off-kilter as it is, I find her very, very effective in that moment.
I actually like the guy who was Rose's ex, who has like two scenes. He has the one scene where he asks, you know, for the money and the weed, and then she kicks him out, and then the other scene when the cop goes to his house. I thought he seemed pretty genuine to me. Martha grew on me by the end of the film. Like, I feel like the moments are really there in this movie that if there were real actors, like, they'd be killing it. They'd be knocking this shit out of the park. But because, like, I don't really, like, it's mostly for me, it's the guy, like, the boy, because Martha has a really good moment again at the very end when she's in jail behind bars, and there's that like, horrible visiting room that I've never seen portrayed before that had to be real, you know, like, you never see people go to prison and visit people and have it portrayed behind, like, it'll look like a fallout shelter door or something. It was just really weird and creepy. And I feel like when she's telling him all this stuff, I'm like, yeah, I'm feeling that. But then you just have him on the other end going like, I don't know. And it's totally killing like everything she's given me. I'm like, oh no, oh, it's just not landing on the other side of the door. So like, yeah, I do feel like the non-acting thing isn't a total loss. Like, there could be value to it beyond just the gimmick of these people aren't actors. But I'm not sure if these guys pulled it off entirely.
I do wonder if having real actors really would have made a difference, because this was based on an outline by the guy who also wrote or did an outline for Full Frontal.
The woman.
The woman, I'm sorry, by, oh, I'm so sexist, I'm
well,
such a pig.
Well, it's Coleman Huff. Like, there's no way to know from the name. Like, it sounds like a man's name.
It sounds like a law firm.
Yeah.
I didn't go deep on any of these names in this movie, but here, like, Soderbergh also shot and edited and cinematography and like did like, you know, Peter Andrews as one and his mother's name and maiden name as another, and just all these different things that like he was wearing so many hats that I didn't investigate further because I figured it was just basically like five people on set and it's Soderbergh and four actors and we're just gonna do this. Anyway, getting back to what I was saying, I don't know if having real actors would have made a difference, because in Full Frontal, where they're just sort of aimless and just sort of slice of life, and there you see real actors and you're like, why aren't they doing more? You know what I mean? Like, here, not having real actors, you're sort of able to be like, well, I'm not going to expect knockout Oscar-winning performances, and anything I get above that, it's sort of like a positive. If you had Julia Roberts and you had like a Margot Martindale and you had a Brad Pitt, it would have been a completely different everything.
Well, I don't think you get famous actors. I just think you get real actors.
Actors,
yeah,
okay.
Like, you go further than community theater, like, or the drive-in. Like, you actually just, you know, you get no-name people, but people who have actually been in front of a camera, been, like, on a stage, has had to memorize lines. Like, I'm not saying you got to go Brad Pitt, but, yeah, just, you know, working actors.
I do really want now that I said it, I do want character actress Margot Martindale to be in this movie as Martha. That would be pretty, I would like that.
Well, she should be in everything. I mean, that goes without saying.
I agree.
I'll dissent again. I think that having non-actors in this movie is... We are used to evaluating movies and movie performances by a certain standard, by a certain style of acting. And that style has changed over the years in cinema. I mean, you look at silent movies of people who are considered, you know, so realistic and so sort of just true. And you watch them now and you think, oh, that seems very artificial. That doesn't seem very real. And we're going to look back. People are going to look back if people are still around in a few more generations at a Brad Pitt or a Julia Roberts or movie stars now who are giving what seem very realistic performances and say, oh, that's weird. Like, we don't act like that anymore. And so I think that this is just a different style, right? This is a movie as steeped in style as anything else that he's done. And there's something for me about non-actors when the movie is just totally filled with people who aren't actors, is that they're not acting. And I would prefer someone not acting to someone acting badly. And I think that one of the reasons to not get somebody even from community theater, but to get somebody who just is just a person who lives this life and then give them these lines to say and then shoot them the way Soderbergh does, it's all in the shots. It's all in the way that he frames them and the way that he cuts to them listening to one another and the looks to one another. That's part of the power of cinema. You don't need actors. They don't need to be acting. And so then at that moment where she is called upon to act at the end and does so honestly, I find much more sort of haunting, because it feels like a real woman who's really being broken in that moment, and not like the way we think of, you know, tearing their hair out, gnashing their teeth, the way an actor would approach and sort of calculate that scene. And I think I would stake a claim for that in this movie and other movies that I know I'm not alone on, but I'm pretty close to it. But I do think that in this movie in particular, I think that really works for me anyway.
So Tobin, where do you have this on your list of favorite Soderbergh movies, aside from Way Too High?
I have it at number 9.
Oh, okay. That's not bad.
Right now mine goes Out of Sight, Ocean's 11, The Limey, Traffic, Aaron Brockovich, Ocean's 12, Schizopolis, Sex Lies, The Videotape, and then Bubble. And so I put Bubble in with the Bubble, Kafka, King of the Hill, Solaris, these movies that that I like, maybe even love parts of, or kind of, it's on the love end of that spectrum, but I'm not, I'm not going to return to it a ton. It is, I think this is a much more successful experiment than something like Full Frontal. I would say that.
Absolutely. I feel like it's got more direction. It's more centered, more focused. Full Frontal just felt like so haphazard to me, even thinking about it now, comparing it to this, like this is way... Yeah, I would definitely revisit this before watching that again.
Well, I don't have anything else to say about this movie. I didn't hate it. I just didn't like it as much as I sort of hoped that I would. I didn't think I was going to love it, but I always... These weirdo little movies, they could really go one of two ways, and like this one sort of didn't go either. I didn't love it, and I didn't hate it. It was just sort of in the middle. I was like, oh, that's an unexpected result. Toby, anything else to say about Bubble?
One last thing, which is that one of the things that I get such a charge out of it with this movie every time is at the doll factory, there's this boss and he has the best haircut in the world. It's worth looking for a still of that or watching the movie. It's only 73 minutes to find this guy's haircut, because it is, no one in a movie has ever had a worse non-ironic haircut in their life. And I applaud that man for wherever he had his hairstyle, because I think I laugh at that every time.
Mike, any last non-hair related thoughts or hair related thoughts? Either way.
I feel like it's not as bad as I might be making it out to be. I liked it more than I'm coming off, but I just don't feel like it completely worked for me. You know, that's all I'm getting at. I just needed more. I like the concept of non-actors, no script, sort of film school shoot, like let's just go out and like let's just make them like a, you know, a pure movie. You know, this is like probably closer to like some of that Dogma stuff that we've previously talked about before, and maybe veering into that sort of territory. And he's good at it. I think he's good at it, but I kind of want to see him just make like great movies instead of okay movies. And I know he's got great movies in him, so when he makes movies like this, I understand what he's doing, but I'm frustrated a little bit watching them from time to time, where I'm just like, yeah, you could do anything. Like, you're great. You can do Ocean's huge big movies, and then you could do these tiny little DV movies, and that's awesome, but I just want to see your awesome movies. You know, it's fine though. Like, this is not nearly as bad as something like Full Frontal, as far as I'm concerned. Like, yeah, this is watchable. You could get through it, and there are definitely things about this that I appreciate. But just on a whole, it just didn't completely work for me.
Are there other directors, either that we're going to do, Mike, or that we're not going to do, or Tobin, that you just think of, who, well, I guess the Coen brothers, too, like, that vary so wildly between blockbuster and, like, weirdo little, like, sort of essentially micro-budget, $100,000 budget movies?
I feel like the Coen brothers tonally have drastic shifts from film to film, but I don't feel like they've ever made, like, a blockbuster, huge, big blockbuster film, but, like, there is, like, in the way of Soderbergh that, like, from film to film, they can throw you sort of off-kilter from what you're expecting.
I think the Coen brothers have made accidental blockbusters. They've never made anything. They're not as sort of stylistically diverse by any stretch as Soderbergh is.
I wonder what their biggest budget ever is. Probably, would it be something for like Intolerable Cruelty? Do you think that's, it's got to be up there probably, right? Spoiler alert, we will be covering them, I don't know, years down the line? I don't remember when we're doing the Coen brothers, but we're going to do them soon-ish. They're scheduled. I just don't remember where they are. I'm just wondering, because I mean, like, Soderbergh very clearly has, like, okay, this is a $150 million movie, and then now here's a movie that I can do from, like, the coins that I find between my couch cushions or whatever. It's fascinating in that way.
Yeah, it really is. This is one of the cool things about starting with Soderbergh, is getting to see, as we were talking about at the beginning, him not only sort of develop as an artist and to see where his, these tools that he plays with, like using non-actors or whatever in one movie, get like translated into something kind of wild later on. And then all the way out to the fact that he experiments with how movies are released and with how they're, how the money is raised and all that kind of stuff, I think is one of the really cool things about starting with him.
Well, for all the episodes of Cinemakers that we've already done and everything that's still to come, and I do want to sort of give us credit, even though it has something to do with us, that he is now, it seems like he's more active now than he was, far more active now than he was, even when we started recording this a couple months ago. I mean, we've sort of returned him from obscurity into mainstream film, that not only is Logan Lucky coming up, but he's also, they just announced that he shot an entire other movie, like, in secret.
Oh, on an iPhone, yeah.
It feels like he's doing all this different stuff, so I mean, this might be the, we might never get to a next director, because he just seems like he's churning them out fast. Then we can turn them out, so we will see. But for all things Cinemakers, everything we've done, everything's going to come next, as well as all of our other podcasts, you can go to cageclub.me or facebook.com/cageclub or at cageclubpod on Twitter. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or Google Play. You can email us. You can just email Joey at cageclub.me. We can read stuff on there if you have thoughts about Cinemakers. We don't really do that on any other show other than Zach Dak, but I mean, you can always email us. That's it. Go to those places, do those things. Everything's free, and enjoy. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
I'm Mike Manzi.
And I'm Tobin Addington.
And we'll see you next time on Cinemakers.